If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
All right. How you doing, Reg? Good. Yeah, I got that. Microphone all set. You Freddy? Are you ready, Freddy? Freddy, ready? Get these things out of the way now. That's why I talked to you at the beginning of this, before we actually start recording and get all of this ready, because I need to get those little out of my mouth. I got to, you know, clear that tongue and those teeth and get that saliva working. You know, you got to prepare your instrument. You know what I mean, my friend? Okay. I think instrument is prepared. Now, are you ready to podcast? See that? Okay, good. So am I. At least I think I am. All right. Put it in the book. Episode. Ooh, doggy. In the words of Jed Clampett. I know you don't get that reference. Doggy. Episode 480. 480, my friend. All right. Here we go. Star, smile strong. Get ready on the trigger finger. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. There we are. Did you see that? I usually say, we are there, but I said, there you are. You listening close? See, these are not pre-recorded, folks. These are all coming to you live. Want to thank you so much for listening to the podcast. You know I appreciate that, but I also appreciate when you get out there and tell your friends. So get out there and tell your friends, your family, anyone who listens to a podcast, that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. And of course, if you like what you hear, you go to WGNRadio.com, you go to the podcast section, you hit the prompt for this podcast, and what a gift you will get. Podcast after podcast after podcast, stretching back, whoa, years. What was that, Reg? Whatever it was, let's keep going. So keep scrolling down and loading more and enjoying where you've been so you know where we're going. Right now we're going to episode, get this, 480. 480. Reggie, the producer, did you hear that little? Did you hear that? What was that? See, now it'd be easy for me just to say, let's re-record this. But no. I enjoy the flaws. That's what makes this podcast real. Oh, sure, we could have just said cut, done it over, and been pristine. But maybe somebody didn't hear it. Maybe somebody did. Now there's a mystery. Now they're going to go back and listen to the beginning to see if they heard this little flaw that I'm talking about, if, in fact, it was there. Ooh. Oh, the mysteries always continue here on Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Thank you for listening. As I said, episode 480. Can you believe it? We've got only 20 to go until we hit the magic number of 500. Wow. Well, you know, this is becoming a sad... what's the word? I guess trend. I've talked about this in the past about rock stars, but I don't know if it's basically now going to extend to a lot of different public figures in a lot of different areas that have come to great renown and respect among people. But what I'm talking about is, you know, doing kind of a tribute to somebody that's recently passed away, who at least, you know, has had a big impact, if not on me personally, but as well, or on the wider, larger world. And sadly, you know, have to do one of these again, although I do it with great respect and enthusiasm, because I believe that this individual deserves that, and that's the reason why I'm doing it on this podcast and mentioning it. But I had said that, you know, the age of rock stars, you know, I'm big into music, so of course that's always been a priority. And I'm just saying how, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, probably closer to 7, if not shorter, we're going to start to see more and more very well-known, in some cases legendary, you know, rock stars and rock personalities passing away just because of the fact of how many years it's been. I mean, rock and roll pretty much stretches back to the 50s, if you think about it, with Elvis and things like that. I mean, you know, Bill Haley, stretching back to, you know, the mid-50s. We're practically at a 70-year-old, you know, a 70-year birthday for rock and roll, when you think about it, with Bill Haley and some of the early rockers, definitely in 1955. And so recently, you know, been talking about, you know, some people here and saying, wow, this is really getting scary. Didn't even mention the fact that since we spoke last, another rock star, Ozzy Osbourne, just passed away at age 76. And one that didn't get much attention, but it did for me. Ironically, I had no idea what kind of health he was in or anything else. But if you list, if you ever go on my Facebook page, you will see that that I have been, since 2015, I have been doing a daily feature on my Facebook page called Elton Jim's Jam-Packed iPod. Now, first of all, that shows you just how old this feature is, going back to 2015, because at that time, iPods were pretty cool, and iPods even existed. Not only were they cool, they actually existed. And now, I mean, if they do, they're relics. They are like 8-track tape players for the 21st century, or for the millennials and the Generation X's or Z's, I mean. Yeah, the iPod is kind of like, what? You pulling out an iPod today is kind of pulling out like a transistor radio, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. Yeah, but 10 years ago, iPods were still pretty cool. They were on their way out, but they still had a little life in them. But what I do, I mean, I said I've got 24,000 songs on my iPod. I can't certainly get rid of it. Most of my record collection, I recorded onto that. I downloaded into my iPod so I could carry it with me. Now you just go online and basically just access any song you want. It doesn't really matter. You don't even really need a record collect, which is really strange. I mean, when I think about the money that I spent on my record collections through my years, wow. I mean, you don't need it anymore. Subscribe to a service, and pretty much any song you ever want is just there at your access. But there will always be people like me who are audiophiles, who are record collectors and things, and so there will always be a place, but certainly not like it used to be. And there's a whole generation that don't even know what it means to have a record collection of any kind, whether it's CDs or albums or anything else, because it's all stored right there in your phone. So if you go on my Facebook page, you'll see every day, and I've been doing this every day for now more than 10 years, I feature a song from my iPod. Most of the time, I try to feature a song that is not well known, to expose people to some cool songs that I think deserve to be heard. Or sometimes they are well-known songs, but you just haven't heard them in a real long time. You know, so the idea is to hopefully expand people's listening experience to some extent, or to at least remind them of the good old days, of some great songs you may not have thought about or heard of in a long time, because they don't get played on the radio all that much anymore, or And people don't even listen to the radio for music all that much. So some of these songs will be gone forever. And so that's kind of the goal of that. And people seem to appreciate it. I get a lot of different reactions from people when I pick a certain song. Oh, my goodness, I haven't heard this one in a long time. Or, wow, I never heard this song before. And that's the whole point of that. And what I was talking about here was about a week before Chuck Mangione died, and that's who I was talking about. He passed away on the same day or just a day or so after Ozzy Osbourne, and Ozzy Osbourne's death kind of eclipsed Chuck Mangione's. But it was just wild because I had just featured on that Facebook feature the Chuck Mangione song Feel So Good, which is probably his best known song, was a major hit in the late 70s, early 80s. You know, with the Trump, he was a trumpeter. He was a jazz trumpeter, you know. Yes, that was me, folks. Yeah, I mean, my instrument is multi-talented. It's just not talking. You know, I could do a... I wasn't planning on doing the whole intro there, but I was kind of digging it. I liked the fact that it sounded... I thought it sounded... You tell me. I thought it sounded like you could actually hear Chuck Mangione blowing into the horn. I was trying to get that kind of effect going. Anyway, I was like, wow, I just featured this Chuck Mangione song, which I hadn't heard of in years. I actually did to myself what I'm trying to do with that Facebook feature was, you know, say, oh, here's a song you haven't heard in a long time. And then I pull that out. And then a week later or so, Chuck Mangione passes away at age 84. And as I said, this is kind of what I've been talking about, is that we're going to start to hear more and more, especially musicians, of a certain age, especially the ones from the 60s and 70s, because now they are in their 70s and 80s. And I mean, ironically, with Ozzy Osbourne, he had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease many years ago, and he has not been in good health, and he's been in failing health for many years. And then they obviously, the family and Ozzy must have known that his health was getting very seriously, bad, because they staged this farewell concert in his hometown of Birmingham in England. And like within a couple of weeks, he passed away. And by all accounts, he didn't do as long as a set. He only did like four or five songs with Black Sabbath. And he was sitting in a throne because by this time the Parkinson's had affected his ability to walk. So, I mean, the man was not in good shape, but he certainly was inspired enough to get out there, and he had a big smile on his face, and what a way to go out. I mean, he obviously was able to experience the love that and respect from his fans and his peers one last time. That was, like I said, my gosh, within a couple of weeks, he went from that concert to being gone. And about a week or so after his death, his town of Birmingham, where he had gone back to do this performance, I guess there's a bridge called the Black Sabbath Bridge in this small town. And the family, the Osbourne family, which obviously came to prominence in the early 2000s with their reality show, The Osbournes, on MTV, which really made Ozzy, ironically, the Prince of Darkness. He made him this household name and this lovable father of the new century, with Sharon and their kids, Jack, and now I'm blanking on the other on his other daughter's name. What's her name? Sharon Osbourne. I actually remember the daughter's name, who was not on the show, who was Amy, but now I'm blanking on his daughter's name. I know there's Jack Osbourne, and what's Ozzy's daughter's name? Kelly Osbourne, right? Okay, But and she was also on the show. Amy was never on the show, actually. She didn't want to take part in that. But Kelly and Jack certainly became celebrities, as well as Sharon, who wound up being a television star. And Ozzy, I mean, in her own right, as a judge and a talk show host. And Ozzy, of course, it just raised his awareness from being just a well-known rock star who, up to that point, was probably best known for reportedly biting the head off of a bat during either a concert or a press conference. The story is notorious. It's told many ways. Who knows what it really is? But that was pretty much what he was known for. But the Osbourne Show just changed his entire awareness and persona. And so it was quite a send-off for Ozzy Osbourne. But my point is that we're starting to see that many of these rock stars that at once were so young and vibrant and full of energy and life and attitude and whatever, they still have that attitude, but hey, everybody is mortal, and time affects everyone. And so we're starting to see more and more prominent rock stars passing away, and the ones that are still alive are now pushing into their early 80s. And so, as I said, the next 4 or 5 years, we could see some major names sadly leaving us. And that's what I want to talk today, because unfortunately, the person I want to talk to today is not a rock star, but he's a sports star. And he wasn't in his 70s or even 80s. He was a relatively young man. I mean, I guess I say relatively because that's the way you can look at it. If you're 20, he certainly wasn't young. But if you're somebody in your mid-50s to early 70s, you might consider him young. I still think we consider age 65 relatively young in today's world. But yes, it was a very sad day if you were a Chicago Cubs fan or a baseball fan, in all, for that matter, to hear about the passing of Ryne Sandberg. At age 65, he announced early last year in 2024 that he had had a serious case of prostate cancer. It actually had a tumor, and he was undergoing therapy and treatment for that. And it sounded as if by the middle of last year that he announced that he was cancer-free and that everything was fine, and it was like, wow, that's great, because prostate cancer seems to be one that now, if caught early, like any kind of serious disease, we can at least treat it in some way, and it doesn't have to be a death sentence like it used to be. But it depends, once again, on the aggressiveness of the cancer. Everybody's different. You can't really put down any kind of, this is now easily curable for everyone. That's just not the case. And sadly, toward the end of 2024, Sandberg announced that sadly his cancer not only had returned, but it was spreading. And over the last month or so of this year, the news was getting out kind of in a subtle way that things were not going well. And so the news, while shocking, wasn't altogether shocking, because I guess we had been prepared, but it still was a shock for anybody who grew up in the 80s. And if you were born anywhere, in that time period, or you lived in that time period and you were a sports fan, especially if you were a Cubs fan, you knew, and in many cases you idolized Ryne Sandberg. Ironically, for his status and his accomplishment, Hall of Famer, All-star many times, 10-time Golden Glove winner, several records in terms of fielding and chances and home runs for a second baseman, at least at the time of his retirement, Slugger of the Year awards, Silver Slugger awards, I mean, you name it. Many consider him, when you put together all the pieces, the fielding, which was, I mean, I think he had a 0.989 fielding percentage, which basically says the guy rarely made an error, in his entire career, which went from about 80. Well, he was on the Cubs in 82. I know he played for a cup of coffee maybe in 1981, So about 16 years total. There was a couple of years in between that he did retire in 94 and came back in 96. So, but my point is, over that span, I mean, the guy was as dependable as in the history of the game as possible at second base. And even though he was not a big hulking guy, like some people, like you see, like you know, Barry Bonds, or you know, at that time, Mark McGwire. Now, obviously, there's the steroid whispers about that. But Sandberg was a tall guy. He was 6'2", but it wasn't as if he had this big, giant physique. He was very slim and lanky almost. But he wound up hitting 277 home runs, which at the time when he retired was the most home runs for a second baseman. So people can debate. There's been some great second basemen in the history of the game, both fielders and hitters, and those that combined both. The one that immediately comes to mind was somebody who actually played also in the Sandberg era, but you know, he was leaving the game as Sandberg began to excel. But that was Joe Morgan of the Cincinnati Reds, Hall of Famer. But when you combine, like I said, the hitting records and the fielding records, it's hard to argue that Ryan Sandberg just might have been the greatest second baseman of all time. To many people, that may sound strange because the guy was not flashy. He was not a spotlight hound. He wasn't looking to promote himself. He was a very introverted kind of guy, and even though he broke out of that shell a little as he started to attain this great notoriety and fame, for the most part, he was still very soft-spoken. You could see that while he was a little more comfortable in the spotlight, it wasn't like he thrived on it. He was certainly not a personality of the 21st century, where today everybody wants attention. Everybody craves attention, and because of our access to many platforms, most people can get the attention they're looking for. Whether it's the amount of attention or the kind of attention they want, it doesn't matter, but they can get some attention because you can just go on, put any little TikTok video up there and someone might watch it even for a second. I mean, we are attention-starved and attention-craving narcissistic society. Well, that's not the way things were when Ryan Sandberg played. Although I shouldn't say that. The funny thing is, in the 80s, that's when our society, and especially sports, began to shift. I've talked about this in the past to some extent. All aspects of our society were not like they are, like we're today, like the look at me society, which is what we are. In fact, if you showed off, especially in sports, you were considered a hot dog, was the title. You're a hot dog. There was a first baseman called Willie Montanez who was kind of flashy. He would catch the ball in a certain way. He kind of slap at it with his glove, and he was trying to call attention to himself. Well, that was looked down on by many of his peers. Oh, he's a hot dog. But especially in the 80s, that started to change. Don't forget, that was the birth then in real ways of the video camera, even though we didn't have it in our phones because we didn't have cell phones at that time, or iPhones or smartphones. But that was the birth of the camcorder becoming a mass kind of technology, and the videotape recorder. And suddenly people started to... There was always 16-millimeter films. I mean, there was always film cameras for people at home. But the camcorder and the VCR recorder, those were a little more accessible. You didn't have to get it developed. You could take it and look at it right there. It was digital, and it changed everything. And really, that in the 80s, especially with MTV, when music became more visual, we became much more of a visual society, and with that, the games and our behaviors changed. And baseball and all sports in the early to mid 80s really started to change. And what was once taboo, which was once kind of a unwritten rules, especially baseball has a lot of those, you didn't call attention to yourself, you're part of the team. Well, those days ended. Now when a guy hits a home run, he flips the bat, he stares, he watches it. 30 or 40 years ago, that was unheard of behavior. It was frowned upon. Your teammates didn't even want you to do it. Forget about the other team. You weren't only making the other team mad by showing off the pitcher or the other team by standing and watching your home run and saying, well, look how great I am. Your own teammates didn't want you to do that. They felt that that was showboating. But today, that is part of the game. The look at me, take a bow, and the pitcher in the old days, in my day, if a batter in the real old days, if you hit a home run, right? That's your job, right? You're up there to get a hit. So a guy gets up there to hit and hits a home run, right? In the old days, it was an unwritten rule. It was expected. The next guy up to bat, doesn't matter who it was, because the guy in front of him hit a home run and the pitcher was mad, the tradition was, the unwritten rule was that the next batter was going to get a pitch thrown high inside, most likely for him to go to evade the getting hit in the face, would have to get down and go on the ground to avoid getting smacked by the pitch. The pitcher, that was automatic. You knew that the next guy, the ball was going to be thrown at him, because it was this unwritten rule that, okay, your team hit a home run off of me, I'll show you, and down you go. And that slowly started to fade as injuries and things like that, people became more cognizant of that. But in the old days, that was the unwritten rule. If a guy hit a home run, even though it's his job, it didn't matter. You showed up the pitcher, you made the pitcher mad, the next guy up to bat, it almost made the guy, like, you didn't want to hit a home run because, like, if you were on deck waiting to bat, you're like, please don't hit a home run because this guy's going to throw a ball at me. But my gosh, those days are over now. If you hit a home run, you didn't look at it and watch it. That was showing up the pitcher. Now, that's all they do. So the game has changed quite a bit. And in the early 80s, that's when this kind of showboating started to get more popular. You know, don't forget, cable television began to grow. More people were now watching ESPN. There were more sports on all the time. Then there were Sports Center. Before the early 80s, television and the expansion of cable television, you still had your three networks and things were fairly controlled. But when cable came, you had more stations, you had more eyes, you had 24-hour programming, and that's when, to fill those hours, especially ESPN, part of the most successful and longest, cable sports network, they were highlighting this stuff. They needed content. And the players decided, oh, I'll give you some content. And so that's when the personalities and the hot dogging and the showboating, which at one time was frowned upon, became a major selling point of the game. And now it's commonplace today. But aside from that, Ryne Sandberg was not that player at all in his career through the 80s and even into the mid to late 90s. He just wasn't that way. And so that's why if you call Sandberg the greatest second baseman of all time, some people will go, oh, well, no, that's not true. Because as great as he was, the statistics show it, as popular as he was, not only in Chicago, but nationally, he was always voted to all-star teams. But he wasn't the flashiest, biggest name that immediately came to mind, because he just went out there and played the game. He was really a quiet guy, a true pro, went about his business. He was a real ball player. He enjoyed playing baseball and being a baseball player, and it showed. And so that's why his death really struck a lot of people, as I said, especially here in Chicago, and especially a certain age group of people. When he was in his prime, really when he came into his own, you could, and there's not many times you can say to a person like, well, when did your life change? On what day? I mean, you know, most of our lives change in many ways, goes ups and downs, and you know, it's a gradual kind of thing. But every so often, some people have a touchstone moment in their lives. And I'll talk about this later. But Ryne Sandberg had one. And it was June 23rd, 1984. That's the day Ryne Sandberg's life changed. His career and his life changed forever. And in the process, he really helped change the Chicago Cubs. And not only the Chicago Cubs, but the entire Chicago Cub baseball experience, especially at Wrigley Field. But let me just tell you a little bit about Ryne Sandberg. He was from Spokane, Washington. He was a great football player in high school as well as baseball player. He chose to play baseball. He steadily rose through the ranks. He was in the Philadelphia Phillies organization. And this is, when you hear these stories, it's interesting to show how people's lives are affected by either certain people or circumstances. And in some ways, you really can't predict these. You put yourself out into the world, and you open yourself up to opportunity, and sometimes the luck and the opportunity takes you, and sometimes it takes you to a certain point, and sometimes it just passes you by. That's the reality of realities of life. But for Ryne Sandberg, he started out, as I said, got drafted in the Phillies organization, was well-respected in the minor league system. Interestingly, at that time, the Phillies manager was a guy named Dallas Green, who led the Phillies to a world championship in 1980, and he was really one of the most respected and winningest people in baseball at the time. So much so that in 1982, he was hired to rejuvenate the Cubs. He had just won a championship as a manager, and now he was given a great promotion to be the president and general manager of the Chicago Cubs. Now, you have to understand, I've talked about this before, it's hard to realize or even accept the fact when you look at this, at the scene that is a Chicago Cubs home game now. The whole Wrigleyville experience, the rooftops, the bars, the restaurants, the hip neighborhood, all of that. It's hard, and I've just talked about this recently. I know it's hard to look at it and say, what are you talking about? But believe me, more than 40 years ago, that didn't exist. And to be honest with you, when it really started to take hold was once again in 1984. And Ryne Sandberg's popularity and what he did on the field with especially the 1984 Cubs team, I say, is responsible for what you see today at Wrigley Field. The rooftops, the neighborhood, the bars, the restaurants, the whole scene, the whole hipster vibe, the Wrigleyville name. There was no such name as Wrigleyville 40 years ago. That was called Lakeview. It was the popularity of the 1984 Cub team. And the irony is that while Ryne Sandberg is one of the all-star or one of the Hall of Famers from that team, it was truly a great team effort that allowed that team to come in first place, win the league championship, and come within one game of going to the World Series for the first time since 1945. And by all accounts, they should have gone. All they had to do in those days, there were no wild cards, there were no all these other stuff. It was just the two first place teams played. Winner of that goes to the World Series. It was and not only that, it was a best of five series, not even a best of seven like most of the series are today. It was a best of five to get to the World Series. So that means you have to win two out of three. The Cubs had home had the first two games at home, and they won them going away. They went to San Diego 2-0. All they had to do is win one out of the next three games in San Diego to go to the World Series, and they lost three in a row. It was a heartbreaker. And then the San Diego Padres, who beat them, got beaten by the Detroit Tigers, and I believe when you look at the players man for man, I think if the Cubs had beaten San Diego, which they should have, all they had to do was win one game out of three, and it was a heartbreaking loss that last game, they would have beat the Detroit Tigers, I believe, and they would have been the world champions. So unfortunately, while Ryan Sandberg, just like Ernie Banks and so many Cubs greats, never played in a World Series, the 84 team, of which Sandberg was one of the leaders, but certainly not the leader. That team had many, many great players and leaders, like Gary Matthews and Jody Davis and Ron Say. You name it. That team was full. Great pitcher. Rick Sutcliffe won the Cy Young Award in 84. I mean, the Cubs just were on fire. And what made the frenzy so crazy and why it helped rejuvenate that entire neighborhood and Wrigley Field in general was because, and once again, I know it's hard to understand this, but the Cubs were horrible for more than 10 years. From 1973, I would say, until 1984, the Cubs were horrible. Horrible. Just a horrible, they were in last place or close to it. They were just awful. Awful, awful, awful. They had some good players here and there, but as teams, they were a perennial loser. And I know when you go to your Wrigley Field now, especially in the shadow of the 2016 World Series and champion, you say, "Well, how could that be?" As I said, when I was talking about Lee Elia a couple of weeks ago, who was the first manager that Dallas Green hired when he took over, there was nobody coming to the games. That was what Lee Elia's rant, his famous rant, which I talked about, is all about. There's only 5,000 people coming out here to Wrigley Field, and they're booing us. That was his problem, even though the team was horrible and losing. But my gosh, when you go to a game now, especially on a weekend or whenever, sold-out crowds, craziness. The neighborhood is abuzz. That didn't exist, but the 1984 team and Ryan Sandberg played a major role in that, made the Cubs cool again. Ryan Sandberg was the first legitimate Cubs superstar / legend since Ernie Banks. Ernie Banks retired, I think, in 1971. It took 13 years for the Cubs to have another player that could actually be looked at in the same way to be called Mr. Cub. I mean, Ernie Banks is always Mr. Cub, but if anyone also had those same traits of loving the game, playing it well, loving the fans and the team, it was Ryan Sandberg. He came as close to anyone to being able to be called Mr. Cub. And just like Ernie Banks in many ways, he did it in a very unassuming and almost embarrassed way. Ernie Banks was not a showboater. One of the greatest players of all time. You'd never know that this guy, you know, was a two-time MVP, 500 home runs, one of the greatest players of all. But he wasn't a showboater. And he didn't play in a World Series, and he didn't play in New York. And so he's oftentimes overlooked. Ryan Sandberg had the advantage of playing during a time when, as I said, overall sports and baseball were elevated by the coverage it was gaining because of ESPN and cable television, which was expanding the content universe. So despite his aversion to the spotlight, it was still thrown on him. And as I say, you talk about the things that happen to you in life. So here's Ryan Sandberg. He's in the minor leagues. Dallas Green was in the Philly organization. He certainly knows all the players in their organization. When he goes over to the Cubs as its president and general manager, He wants Ryan Sandberg. He puts together a trade. At the time, the main players were the two shortstops for each team. Larry Boa, a longtime Phillies all-star shortstop who was on their 1980 World Series team. And on the Cubs, an all-star guy named Ivan DeJesus. Now, the Cubs were terrible, but DeJesus was a very good player on that team, and he became an all-star. And he was younger than Larry Boa, and as I said, so the Phillies wanted DeJesus because Boa was getting a little older. So Dallas Green said, okay, I'll trade you DeJesus. I'll take Larry Boa, but I want this kid in the minor leagues named Ryan Sandberg. And the Phillies, for the most part, didn't want to get rid of Ryan Sandberg, but they talked. They really wanted DeJesus. They needed a puzzle. They needed some pieces there. They needed a quality shortstop who was proven for the big team. And you don't know while a player might be good in the minors, you never know what they're going to be like in the majors. And while many in the Phillies organization were reluctant to give up on Sandberg, Dallas Green would not make that trade unless Sandberg was involved. And so the Phillies ultimately agreed, and Larry Boa and other players, especially Ryan Sandberg, came to the Cubs. That story came out. The hype on Ryan Sandberg was established. And ironically, in 1983, his first season with the Cubs, he was not starting off very well. He came in with some hype. But in fact, his first 30 at-bats, he only had one hit. He was 1-for-30 to start the season. And so, believe me, I was there. I watched it. The fans and especially the media, oh my gosh. I mean, he came on the Cubs in 82, I'm sorry. His first year, but he didn't, you know, he was just, you know, relatively a rookie, even though he had played in some games with, with the Phillies, but didn't really do much. But he was 1-for-30 with the Cubs. And so they were a blasting. Oh, this was right. This was, you know, once again, you know, Dallas Green came in here with a lot of swagger. I just had the Phillies, you know, as the world champion team. I was the manager. I'm going to build a new tradition was the name of the, was their big slogan, building a new tradition. And Sandberg was a part of that new tradition. A lot of veterans as well that Dallas Green brought to the Cubs. But there's no doubt that Dallas Green was staking his reputation on this young guy named Ryan Sandberg. And when he started, he was 1-for-30. And oh my gosh, the stories about, you know, Dallas Green's big acquisition and this is going to be a flop. Well, at the end of the day, that trade is now known as one of the best trades in Cubs history, one of the worst trades in Philadelphia Phillies history. And one of the most well-known trades in baseball history. So you have to give Dallas Green credit. And you have to give Dallas Green credit because when he came here, the odds were against him based on the way the Cubs had been performing for most of the last 10 years. And he put the team through all of his maneuvers and getting great players to this team. He put the team in the position to win, and they should have won. At the very least, they should have gone to the World Series, which would have been the first time in since 1945. But, you know, he came to the Cubs in 81, and, you know, they weren't doing very well. As I said, he brought in Lee Elia. Sandberg came the next year. 83, they got a little better, and then 84, everything gelled. He brought in people like Gary Matthews, and I said the biggest acquisition was bringing in Rick Sutcliffe in 1984, who around the All-Star break and wound up winning, was going 16-1. I mean, the guy was on fire, and he won the Cy Young Award, and the rest was history. But Ryan Sandberg, the way he approached the game is, as I said before, what people were attracted to. Not only was he performing at a high level, but the way he approached the game, you could see he was just a pro. He played the game. He wasn't flashy. If he tipped his hat, it was almost an embarrassing way for doing something. He didn't thrive on the spotlight. And so that's why for many kids that grew up in that time, you always wanted to be like Ryne Sandberg. He really, as I said before, was the first Cubs legitimate superstar. Kids batted like him. When they played wiffle ball or ball in the streets or at the parks, they wanted to be Ryne Sandberg. He became a role model of not only playing, but how you play. I talked about this before when I was growing up, and I looked at the goalie on the Blackhawks, Tony Esposito. Not only was he a great player, but the way he approached the game, the way he played the game, I really respected. And that was the way that Ryne Sandberg affected little younger kids. And even me at that time. I mean, I was in my late teens, but I could appreciate the kind of player that Ryne Sandberg was. And ironically, he became this home run hitter thanks to the new manager. I talked about Lee Elia a couple of weeks ago about this famous rant because he just passed away. He was replaced by Jim Frey, who Dallas Green beat for his World Series as the manager of the Royals. And after he fired Elia, he brought in Jim Frey in 1984. And Jim Frey saw Ryne Sandberg, as I said, a tall guy. He wasn't big, muscular guy, but he could see that he could hit. He had power. And he changed Sandberg's batting stance and told him how to swing up a little more, to hit the ball farther. And that's what really helped Ryne Sandberg become a home run hitter, which added to this mystique of being the greatest all-round shortstop in baseball history. So as I said, Ryne Sandberg had the natural talent, no question, from an early age. But the people that he met and the circumstances that came to him through that and through others that helped and guided him, you know, anybody who's successful, they talk about being people are self-made. And that's true to some extent. But you always still need some key people, especially early in your life or early in your career, who either see your potential and give you a break or want to take on even more of a role and really help you and push you forward, not for their own reward, but they see something in you to say this person deserves this. And they may go out of their way for you. They may take chances for you. They may give you opportunities that you really on paper don't even deserve. But for some reason, these people identify things with you and they give you that chance. Maybe before you deserved it, but they saw something in you and then that person takes advantage of that. And as I said, Ryne Sandberg definitely had people on his side looking out for him. Yes, it would help their situations too, but they realized that this was somebody who could be good with the right direction and the right opportunities. Dallas Green, I mean, I'm not going to make this trade unless I get this guy. Wow, an unproven, unknown guy. When he came to Chicago, who's Ryne Sandberg? Everybody knew the Larry Bowa and Ivan De Jesus, but one of the things that Dallas Green is most excited about is this new prospect named Ryne Sandberg. Nobody in Chicago, nobody heard of this guy. And it's like, wow, Dallas Green's he's not going to make a trade unless this guy, holy cow. You know, Jim Frey saying, okay, this guy, I got this Sandberg guy, he seems to be doing okay, but I think I can make him a home run hitter. Why did he do that? Even Harry Carey, who also was a huge part of that entire 84 team and that entire Cubs mystique of creating the whole Cubs mystique, he helped Ryne Sandberg. I can't tell you how many, especially from the 80s and the 90s and even in the early 2000s, people either named their kids Ryne, especially named their dogs Ryne. I knew so many people in the 80s and 90s whose dog's name was Ryne. And a lot of people called him Ryan because we don't know the name Ryne. They thought it was Ryne Sandberg. And everybody would say Ryne Sandberg and people would say, look, you know, it's Ryne, R-Y-N-E. And in fact, one reason why people got to know his name is because Harry Carey, as Samber began to develop, when he came to the Cubs, he gave Ryne Sandberg the nickname Rhino, R-Y-N-O. And so then you couldn't say Rhino. That would make no sense. So when you called him Rhino, then you kind of realized his name was Ryan. But of course, that was his nickname, and it still stayed with him. But Harry, no doubt, was also a key member. Not only the players on the team, but Harry in the broadcast booth in 1984, when the team would come out on the field to the sounds of Van Halen's Jump, which ironically came from an album called 1984. But there was just a magic about that team. There was a magic about that season. And if you were around during that time, you remember it, because it was as if, for the first time, a Cubs fan's thirst was being quenched. When I grew up, I was too young to remember the 69 Cubs. I heard stories about them, but I don't remember them playing. And I remember Ernie Banks' last couple of years, but I was still a little too young to really appreciate it. But for the most part, in my life, growing up as a kid and a baseball fan, we expected the Cubs to lose every year, and they didn't disappoint us. They were terrible. And that's my point. We got so used to the Cubs being so bad for so long that when this 84 team exploded, it was as if, oh my gosh, we would expect the Cubs to lose. And they'd come out, and they were just hitting home runs, and the pitchers were amazing, and the bullpen, and everything's like, this is what's going on here? This is like a real baseball team. We couldn't believe it was before our eyes, because there were times during all of those horrible seasons in the 70s and even the early 80s where they would go on a run, and sometimes early in the season they might even be in first place, and there was all this excitement. Of course, they just completely declined quickly and were toward the bottom. So we had, like, sometimes during a season over those years, we had glimmers of what it might like to be to have a great team. And meanwhile, we're watching, you know, the Reds and the A's and the Yankees and the Phillies and the Royals and all these teams in the 70s, Pittsburgh Pirates and stuff like that. We're seeing all these teams, you have all the success with all these players, and all we could do is watch because the Cubs were so horrible. And nobody went to Wrigley Field. And nobody hung out in Wrigley Field because there were no bars and restaurants like there are today. And there were no rooftop games. There were no rooftop places to watch. Those were apartment buildings where people lived and watched the games through their window. But all that changed because of the success of the 1984 team, and in many ways because of Ryne Sandberg. And you can't. That needs to be a part of Ryan's memory, and his legacy was not just what he did on the field, but what he did for the Chicago Cubs organization. It was a renaissance. They were no longer losers. He was on another playoff team in 1989. Suddenly, the Cubs were not always a doormat. It was because that 84 team, the entire franchise changed. The expectations from the fans finally changed, and the expectations of the ownership finally changed. Yes, the Cubs could win if you had the right people in the job. That was the lesson. Bringing Dallas Green, the Tribune Company, bringing Dallas Green was a ballsy move. And it showed that if you made the right moves, this team could be good. But for many years, the ownership really didn't care. They acted like they did, but they didn't. Because it showed, if you made the right moves, it was possible. The Cubs weren't inherently bad. They were run bad. Dallas Green, of course, was a big proponent of the night games coming to Wrigley Field as well. Because by the end of the season, playing in all the hot games in the summer, in the heat, in the afternoon, it would take a wear and tear on the team. So he got the lights. He was a big proponent of lights. He did a lot for the Cubs organization. But it all started with Dallas Green, and in many ways, his prize acquisition on which he kind of built his new tradition was Ryne Sandberg. And Ryne Sandberg did not disappoint him. And of course, he wore number 23, which is retired in 2005. And another Chicago sports great, Michael Jordan, wore the same number. He was elected to the Hall of Fame in 2005 and wound up actually being a manager in the Cubs farm system organization. I think he really, really wanted to manage the Cubs. They never gave him that shot. They gave him a shot to learn to be a manager, but they must not have thought that he had what it took, because they never gave him that chance. He was rising up through the ranks in their minor league system, but they never gave him a shot at the manager's job. And I think that disappointed him. And so he went to the Phillies, where he started his career, became a coach there, and he did become a manager. Didn't last very long. He wasn't a very successful manager in the minor leagues, but at least he got to manage. And surprising that, considering the kind of folk hero that he had become here in Chicago, that the Cubs, you know, would not give him, you know, that chance. But as I said, you cannot forget in Ryne Sandberg's legacy, not only what he did for the Cubs team, but what he did for the Cubs organization and the whole Wrigleyville Cubs mystique, which is thriving today. It did not exist in the early 80s. It was sparked by this new success and excitement after the 84 season, where suddenly that neighborhood changed, more bars and restaurants opened, people started coming to the games. It all started because of that 1984 team, as I said, which Ryne Sandberg was one of the most important players. Now, about that one moment in history that I talked about, yeah, June 23rd, 1984. That's the day that Ryne Sandberg's life and career changed forever. Once again, to put this in perspective, I know it might be hard for younger people to understand, but in the early 80s, as I said, we didn't have all of this, these platforms to get information and content. The world was still smaller media-wise. It was beginning to expand, but it wasn't there yet. So much so that baseball game. I mean, now during the summer, you could turn on any state. You could watch some baseball game from somewhere, somehow, whatever you have. Whether you have a streaming service, you have cable, whether you have on the air, you can watch a baseball game somewhere. In many cases, if you get these baseball packages, you can watch 10 games at one time. But in 1984, that capability just didn't exist. It was getting there. It was beginning because of ESPN and cable television, as I said before, but it wasn't there yet. So much so that baseball on a national was only a couple of national games. There was a Monday night game and there was a Saturday afternoon game on NBC. Those were like the big games. So it was a big deal to get on the nationally televised games, because for the most part, these players were playing for their hometown fans, but they weren't getting national exposure to get endorsements or just to get fame or whatever you want to call recognition. That's why in the 70s and 80s, the players that are remembered the most are those who wound up being on the best teams, who then were in the playoffs in the World Series, because then for at least a couple of, you know, for 6 weeks or so during the playoffs, they were on the national spotlight. And many of them, given that opportunity, performed on the big stage. And so that's why so many players from the best teams of those eras, like the Reds and the A's and the Dodgers and the Yankees in the 70s and the 80s, they were best known and they're considered the best of their time, not so much because they were the best, but they were among the best, but maybe not the best, but they were perceived that way because the national audience got to see them, because then the playoffs and the World Series were televised on the networks. So they were on for several, you got to get to know these players. But when they had a national game once a week, I mean, you could watch your local thing here in Chicago. The Cubs were on Channel 9. The Sox were on several different channels, 44 and things like that. But So you got to know your home, your players. Each market knew their players, but the national fans only got to a taste of those other players from the best teams. That's why, like I said, growing up, I can list you the batting order of the Cincinnati Reds when they were the big red machine in the early 70s. Why? Because every Saturday afternoon they were on. They were the best team. They had the best players. I got to know Joe Morgan and Tony Perez and George Foster and Johnny Bench and Don Gullett and Gary Nolan. And I wasn't from Cincinnati, but they were on every week because on the national game, if you only have one game a week, you want to put your best team on there, right? So that's why the same teams always showed up during the 70s and 80s. If you weren't a good team, you didn't play on the national game unless you played against one of those good teams. But for the most part, it was the Reds and the Pirates and the A's and the Orioles and, you know, the Royals. Every week. Because they were the best teams and they had the best players. So you got to know them. I understand it was a weird time. I know in today's world, younger people can't even understand, but that's the way the world was. It was a smaller world at that time. And so on June 23rd, 1984, the Cubs, as now an up-and-coming team, they were starting to put some of the right pieces together, as I said, over the next couple of, last few years with Dallas Green in charge. They were on the rise to the point in the early part of the season, they were toward the top of the division with their longtime rivals, the St. Louis Cardinals. So NBC says, hey, Cubs and Cardinals, Midwest rivals, battling for first place right here in the summer, in the middle of the season. Hey, this is big stuff. Chicago on the rise. Chicago hasn't been a good team since who knows when. They made the Cubs the national game. And Ryan Sandberg, it's called the Sandberg game. You can't get any more particular than that. This game is called the Sandberg game. Why? The Cubs are in the ninth inning. They're down by one run. First place is at stake, even though the season still has several months to go. But there's a lot of excitement. For the first time in most people's memories, the Cubs actually are a good team. They've got some real legitimate players here. This team could win, as crazy as it sounds, and every Cub fan was waiting for them to fall off the table as they'd always done, but this team was different. And it was on this day that they proved to their fan base locally, and they proved to the entire Major League Baseball and to all the fans around the world, watch the Chicago Cubs this year. We're real. We're not the doormats. We're a real team, folks, and look out for us. So you got a battle for first place. You got this Midwest rivalry, and it's on national television. As I said before, opportunities and stepping up when you're in that opportunity and producing. The stage was set. The Cubs are losing by a run in the ninth inning. One of the best relief pitchers in baseball history, a future Hall of Famer named Bruce Sutter, who was on the Cubs in the 70s and was an all-star, but as great as he was, he couldn't do anything to help that team. He went to the Cardinals, and they became one of the best teams in baseball, not surprisingly. So you got one of the best relievers in baseball history. Most of the time, when this guy came in the ninth inning, it was over. You were lucky to get a hit. He had this thing called a split-finger fastball, which was impossible for people to hit. You were lucky to get a hit. He comes in, and Ryan Sandberg, who's now, as I said before, starting to hit home runs. Jim Frey, his manager, starts to teach him how to hit the ball up as opposed to line. He felt he had the power. You could start hitting home runs, my friend. He taught him how, with a little tinkering of his batting stance. Ryan Sandberg does the impossible. He hits on national television in the bottom of the ninth against Bruce Sutter, every odd against you. He comes up to bat, and it's a solo home run and ties the game. Wrigley Field goes crazy. This in because it goes crazy for a couple of reasons. First of all, in the moment, but as I said before, Cub fans were so used to the team failing in big moments that this didn't make sense. It was, you were delirious. There was a frenzy because for the first time, the Cubs broke their tradition. It really was a new tradition. They broke their tradition of always failing in the big moment. The odd, when in this game, as good as the Cubs were playing, when they saw, when Cub fan, the normal Cub fan, when you saw Bruce Sutter on the mound against Ryne Sandberg, having a good season, but, you know, okay, he's not, you know, he's not Babe Ruth. You're like, okay, Cubs lose. Gave it a nice shot. Came within a run of their rivals. You know, could have been in first place, blah, blah, blah. Sandberg changed the expectations, changed the possibilities. We actually now have players on our team who will and can and do deliver in the clutch. We never had that for the last 10 years or so. So you have the best relief pitcher in the game against an up-and-coming player, but not of great note. Nobody around the country knew him at that point. This was before the All-Star game. There was a second baseman on what team? The L.A. Dodgers, well-known team, always on national television, named Steve Sachs. Good player. But he was leading for the second baseman in the All-Star voting, which the fans vote on. Because why? People saw the L.A. Dodgers on national television all the time. Steve Sachs was a good player. Wasn't great, but he was a competent player, very good. He was a good fielder. He came, got some clutch hits. But people saw him play all the time on national television, as I said. So he was leading in the second baseman votes for the All-Star game that year. That would happen in a couple of weeks. As I said, that's usually in July. This was June 23rd, 1984. So as Ryne Sandberg comes up, no one's expecting heroics from this guy, especially not with a team. You got Gary Matthews and all these other players. You don't expect Ryne Sandberg to be this home run hitter that's going to save the game, especially against Bruce Sutter, one of the best relief pitchers in baseball history. But this is what I'm talking about, is seizing the moment, seizing the opportunity. All of those opportunities and those that help that Ryne Sandberg had during his career by other people who saw a potential in him, this moment is when that all came to fruition on that one day and that one at bat. All the people that Dallas Green said, I won't make that trade 3 years before unless I get this guy. Jim Fry, who says, I think this guy could hit home runs. I'm going to change his batting stance. And everyone else who may have helped Ryne Sandberg throughout his career as he grew. All that help, all those opportunities that were created for him because of his talent and because of his potential all came to fruition in this at-bat. And instead of striking out, instead of popping up, instead of hitting a ground ball to the pitcher, he hit a home run to tie the game. Wrigley Field was out of control. I remember watching that game and jumping and screaming. I couldn't believe it. Bruce Sutter even looked at Ryne Sandberg like, who the hell are you to hit a home run off of me? In this situation, Bruce Sutter, there was no question. The Cubs were losing this game. Bruce Sutter looked at Ryne Sandberg like, who the heck are you? Cubs tied the game. But in classic, and this is my point, in classic Cub fashion, we go to extra innings. And what happens? The Cardinals score two runs. So the Cubs come back in this dramatic fashion to tie the game. The fans are going crazy. Everybody in Chicago that's watching this game on national television is going crazy. Even now fans of baseball go, hey, who's this Sandberg guy? What a moment. And here's the best part. The Cardinals score two runs in the top of the 10th. So now the Cubs are losing again, and here we go. And so Cub fans go, well, here we go again. Yeah, there was a moment of excitement, but next inning, instead of building that momentum, they give up two runs, and now they're two runs down. So what happens in the bottom half of that inning? Bruce Sutter is still pitching. Hey, he's their best guy. Now he's got a two-run lead. All he needs is three outs. This game is over this time. Except, guess who comes up to bat with a man on base in the 10th inning? Yeah, Ryan Sandberg. And guess what? Against Bruce Sutter, with a man on base, on national television, Ryan Sandberg hits another home run to tie the game. Oh, my God. When that happened, Ryan Sandberg's name, legend, and star were established forever. The Cubs went on the 11th inning to score one run and win the game. And Ryan Sandberg's heroics to tie the game twice against the best relief pitcher in baseball put him on the map. So much so that within the next couple of weeks before the All-Star voting, Ryan Sandberg was like third or fourth in the voting. He wound up being voted as the starting second baseman. He went from like third or fourth place in the voting to overcoming Steve Sachs and becoming the starting second baseman in the All-Star game. Because of that one game and because what? It was on national television. The Sandberg game, June 23rd, 1984. I remember watching it. I remember screaming and going crazy with the goosebumps. Bob Costas was actually the announcer for that game because it was a national game on NBC. Wow. What a moment. And as I said, that's the day where you could say the Cubs' culture changed, the Cubs' fan base changed, the Cubs' fans' expectations changed, the Cubs' organization changed, and the entire Cubs' mystique and organization. There was a new sense that this team and this organization were not lovable losers, but they could win. And they did that year, and they came within one game of going to the World Series, which I said before, which I believe they actually would have won. But Ryan Sandberg, as I said, then went on to become an ambassador for the team. Cub fans, have always held him in high regard, as I said, not only as a player but as a person. He was a class act. He really was. A baseball Hall of Famer and a hero. His number was retired. Hall of Famer. Last year they gave him a statue, which now stands outside. He lived long enough to see that. So many of the things that were robbed of Ron Santo, which was a shame. Being elected to the Hall of Fame, getting a statue. Ron deserved those high points in his life. For whatever reason, they weren't given to him until after he died. But thankfully, Ryan Sandberg did get a chance to experience being a Hall of Famer, experience getting a statue and being immortalized outside of Wrigley Field for the ages. And as I said, for a certain generation, Ryan Sandberg was the Mr. Cub in the way he played the game, the way he respected the game, and the kind of person he was. He had some personal moments, divorced his wife. There were rumors about her, having affairs and things like that. But Ryan wound up getting remarried, having a family. He overcame all that. As I said, he retired, and then he came back, but he never was the same. What really happened, too, was he never was the same after he got hit by a pitch very seriously in the head, which was one of the reasons why he retired, because he just wasn't the same hitter anymore. And he came back, but you could see that some of that confidence of sitting in there was gone because I think there was still that memory of getting hit in the head by that pitch. And a lot of times he would flinch out of the way of a curveball where he would never stand in there. He used to stay in there, but now after he's a little gun shy. You could see that, and he was getting older. But I think that getting hit by a pitch did mentally change his approach to hitting. But regardless of that, the statistics that he put up, the heroics that he put up, the larger-than-life image he had, not because of his personality, but because of how he played the game, is his legacy. And so for anybody who was a Cub fan in the 80s and 90s, or a baseball fan, you had to respect and idolize Ryan Sandberg, who sadly passed away just a few weeks ago at age 65 after a battle with cancer. One of the great Cubs, one of the great players of all time, and as somebody that grew up during that time and experienced all that frenzy and all that wild excitement in 84, all I can say is thank you, Ryan. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 480. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears. Hey, that a boy, Rhino. Hey.